Welcome, everyone, to the April 2025 Oregon Investment Council meeting. Before we begin, you may notice we have a bit of a new seating arrangement that we will use going forward, where we have various consultants, our general consultants, sitting at the front table, which will help us and help them to have them engaged in the conversations, have some Q&A with them, allow them to chime in on any of the topics that they have thoughts on, which has been maybe difficult in the past if they're somewhere out in the room. So thank you for sitting up there. And when others come up to speak, of course, we have the same three seats that we've always had for the speakers that are on the agenda. With that, we'll get started with a review and approval of last meeting's minutes. Presuming everyone has had a chance to review them, do we have any comments or corrections?
I move to accept the minutes as presented.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, minutes are approved. Next, we'll go to Rex with the committee reports.
It's kind of weird sitting here after 9 years up there, but it's a much better view and I could make eye contact now. Okay, so we've had a few activities since the last OIC meeting. So on behalf of OPERF, $100 million into Advent Global Technology 3, $250 million into Advent International Global Private Equity Fund, and then under staff discretion for OPERF, $5.3 million into Mayfield Select 3. And then on behalf of the Common School Fund, $15 million into Advent International Global Private Equity Fund 11. And that's all the activities.
Thank you. We will move right into our 2025 capital markets assumptions. Presenting will be Makita. And do we have Frank on virtually? Go right ahead.
Good morning. Thank you. Mika Malone with Makita. I'm joined by Alan Emkin, who you all know well. We'll present the capital market assumptions in person, and then Frank Benham, who heads up all of our research at Makita and really leads the committee that creates our capital market assumptions every year, is on the video. So I'll ask him to weigh in a little bit at the end with a few comments, and then he'll be available for questions as well if anyone wants to really dig in to how some of these assumptions were created this year. I also wanted to note at the outset that we have a lot of material in this capital market assumptions deck this time because we wanted to show you how each of these models were created. I don't plan to go through the middle section. It's there for your reference, but certainly if there are questions either while I'm presenting the beginning or the end, please let me know and we can go back to those middle slides as well. I'll begin on slide 4, which is just a quick background for those of you who weren't here a few years ago, the last time we walked through this process with the Oregon Investment Council. Every year, Makita, Aon, most large investment banks, consultants, and actuaries set capital market assumptions. Some groups set them actually and adjust them each quarter. Some set them once a year. Makita sets our capital market assumptions once per year. They're always set on a long-term forward-looking basis. So the standard time periods for us are 10 and 20 years. Some groups issue a 15-year assumption and some call them a blended, say 20 to 30-year or 10 to 20-year assumption. And the reason that there's not perfect consensus in the market around the time frame is that we're looking out a really long ways into the future. And so the reality is anything over 10 years, in my opinion, is an extremely long time. We're going to be adjusting those capital market assumptions annually between now and then. And so while I think this is a really robust process that Makita goes through, that Aon goes through, that other providers you may see or work with go through, we shouldn't assume that there's any real ability to be precise in our knowledge about what will happen over the next 10 or 20 years. That said, asset allocation is the most important decision that you all make. We'll be walking through this year just what I would consider an interim step, which is to look at your asset allocation, consider how the 2025 capital market assumptions feed in to that process and give us expected return and risk expectations for Oregon. And then next year in 2026, we will move into the deeper asset liability process. And that's where we'll take all of those factors into account and we'll do even a more robust dive. So when I walk through these 2025 numbers, there's two things you see them at the bottom of this slide that are important. We'd like you to approve a set of capital market assumptions, and I'll share those at the very end, so that when we come back in May, we can run your portfolio through a variety of scenario testing to kind of help put into perspective the types of environments that we think will impact your portfolio in a variety of ways. And then we'll do 2026 assumptions, Frank and his team, and when we come back next year and do your asset liability study, we'll have a whole new set of capital market assumptions. Given how much the markets have shifted just in the last few months, my expectation is those numbers might look meaningfully different at the end of 2025, so we'll see. I also wanted to note, in terms of what's important to feed into these processes, it's not just returns that Makita or Aon or other groups are setting for the future. It's also the standard deviations. So what type of range do we think those returns will go through across those periods? And then how do the assets correlate to each other? So what are the correlations among asset classes that feed in? So you need those three inputs to create any output in the asset allocation process. On page five, there are a couple of things that are important when we're developing the capital market assumptions. One, we develop these for a variety of what I would call asset classes, sub-asset classes, aggregated asset classes that turn into things like diversifying buckets or real assets buckets. A lot of clients like Oregon have groups of assets that all work together to achieve an objective over time. When we're trying to develop those 113, and we put asset classes in quotes here, we need to have a set of return behavior to look at, so a history ideally to look at. And then we also need information about current pricing and forward-looking information to be able to, again, feed into what gets to that, whether it's a 7% return expectation, a 9% or a 2%, we need to have data. So some asset classes have more easily reviewable data and some are more challenging.
And no client ever uses 113 asset classes. It's just very, very important to remember. The goal is to reduce that to a manageable number.
A very good point. Thank you. Page six goes through, so as we're developing these expectations every year, again, we look at historical behavior. We also take into account how the markets have shifted. So you don't adjust the capital market assumptions just because there is a trade war going on, for example. But if you have a set of data that you can use to predict how certain policies, how certain behaviors in the markets or economic theses will affect those returns over a medium to long-term time horizon, those do feed into some of the models. So when we look at what happened in 2024, a couple of things stand out that do impact long-term returns. That was equity markets rose dramatically across the year, which means that valuations were higher, particularly in U.S. equity markets. So if valuations are higher today, it actually pushes down forward assumptions going forward. And then in bond markets, yields increased. So that means that bond market expectations went up. So those are really the two things that happened over the course of 2024 that really impacted those long-term capital market assumptions. In terms of what process we go through, again, there's kind of three main bullets here. We have the historical averages. We use a lot of traditional financial theory to think about what will drive returns in the future. What are the capital structures in place in these various asset categories? And then, as I just mentioned, thinking about 2024, what are our current measures that we can use to see where we sit today relative to history and relative to future? So all of these things get incorporated into a really robust set of models by asset class that, again, I will not go through in detail because it would put everyone to sleep and it's too early in the morning for that. But I will note that the historical numbers are really, in most cases, one of the smallest components of this. So I don't want anyone to assume that just because an asset has done one thing over the last 10 or 20 or 30 years, that that is necessarily what its future expectations are. There's a lot more that goes into the bottling process. I'm going to move forward to slide 10. And this just gives you a quick snapshot, I think, of what those 10-year forecasts look like. So what's feeding into the various models. So for equities, things like dividend yields, GDP growth. So this is obviously another input that we're watching as the markets shift this year. Current valuations, as we discussed. Bonds, you look at yield to worst, default rates. So if default rates are picking up, that obviously impacts forward-looking expectations here as well. Inflation affects several of these asset categories. And so as all of these things are shifting in the capital markets, that will influence forward-looking returns. And then this is kind of the, you can call it the proof statement, or you can call it highlighting the challenges that we face, depending on how you want to interpret this data. So we show you four charts on slide 11. And what this is showing you is that some factors that are used in this process, and I'd say this is true again for Makita and most other organizations running these, some do a better job of predicting the future than others. So for example, on that top left component of slide 11, investment grade bonds, using that yield to worst measure is a pretty good predictor of forward-looking returns. It's not perfect, but you can see that those blue dots are all moving in that upward slope along with the line in between it. And so the R squared there, which is just a measure of the fit of the model, is 0.89, which is quite good. That's, we sort of call that an A or an A minus if you're thinking about the statistical fit of that model. So looking at investment grade bonds, an area where we all feel like we have a pretty good chance at predicting the future. Again, you're given a yield on these bonds over long time periods. The top right is a little more interesting because this is cash. And what you see is a bit more lumpiness, right? It's really hard to predict when the Fed will change short-term rates. But once that happens, you sort of see that line still moving in the right direction. So the R squared there at 0.74 shows that you're getting a lot of information using the models that are fed into the process for cash, but it's not perfect. And especially with respect to timing, we're always going to be a little ahead of or behind the curve on setting cash expectations. On the bottom left, it gets a lot harder to use cap rates to figure out what forward 10-year returns are in the real estate markets. Probably not a huge surprise. There's so many factors that influence what's happening in real estate. You'll have a presentation today on your real estate portfolio more broadly. And then on the bottom right, U.S. equities. This is using that Shiller-Cape ratio, which is one of those charts that we show you in most of our quarterly performance reports. So looking at kind of where price-to-earnings ratios are and then how that impacts forward-looking returns. And what you see is that directionally, you tend to get a reasonable prediction. But magnitude-wise, we're very, very far off that center in most environments. So I think that that just helps highlight how difficult it is to predict equity returns over the long run. And the R squared there is below 50%. So not a great rate. Any questions just here before I kind of move forward to what we'd like for you to consider for this year's capital market review?
In your process, at what point were these your capital market assumptions decided upon?
So we run our capital market assumptions every January. So we use 2024's data as the most recent time period, updated these, and by the end of January, they're issued.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. And look, I even remember to turn on my microphone. So the chair's question obviously raises a really interesting one, which is, if you reran these models now, is there even any way to rerun these models now, given the instability in predictive value of the economy, right, with the tariffs and the funding freezes and the zillions of other effects of the current administration?
So I'll make one comment, and then I'll ask if Frank wants to weigh in as well. We do have some triggers in our process that would cause us to issue a an update to our capital market assumptions before the next regularly scheduled review. It tends to be when you see equity markets move by around 20%. Frank's going to use a different metric because it's based on how much it moves the forward-looking return, but I'd call it about 20%. We didn't quite get there, and we certainly haven't been in a single place for more than 1 or 2 days, and so that makes it really hard to reissue capital market assumptions. Similarly, in the bond markets, if you're to see rates move by about 100 basis points, that tends to be a meaningful shift and will impact forward return expectations, and that would cause us to revisit and reissue. We've done it, Frank, correct me, twice in the last 15 years. How many times have we reissued? Okay, I thought it was twice. So that's, it's not particularly frequent because you need a sustained change, I think, to justify that. And what we're not seeing right now is a consistent movement in one direction or another to be able to feel confident.
Thank you.
Actually, Frank, did we reissue in 2022 after yields increased? Yeah, he's nodding his head. So 2022, actually.
He is trying to speak.
Okay. That's.
Okay, great. Yeah, sorry. Maybe one of the new technical features sounds like I couldn't unmute myself. So thank you. Yes, so we updated our capital market assumptions twice mid-year. One during the financial crisis because of how much markets moved. And then again in 2022, and that was driven more by the change in interest rates. So it's not just equity valuations that may cause us to make changes. It could also be changes in interest rates. Interest rates actually right now aren't that far from where they were at the start of the year, but clearly if they continue to move in one direction or the other, it's the kind of thing we would keep an eye on and consider. But I think to the nature of the question, the target seems to be moving, so it'd be hard to know that what we're saying today will be the case, you know, 2 weeks from now, let alone 6 months from now.
Okay.
But the important thing to keep in mind is that this is a repetitive process. We're going to come back in a relatively short period of time, particularly when you consider that your liabilities are perpetuities and we redo these on an annual basis. So I don't want to say it's noise, but it's not going to drive a change in the portfolio because the result is strategic asset allocation, which even under the most radical circumstance moves slowly.
Before I move on to kind of the big picture, which I think is on page 35, Frank, is there anything that you would add to my comments or Alan's comments on just how we create the various assumptions?
No additional comments.
And then go to page 35 here, where we sort of summarize a lot of what I've discussed and what the previous slides highlight, which is if you're looking, and we look across 10 years here, because again, to Alan's comment, we don't want to allow small, even a huge change in the capital markets this year can easily be undone over the course of another year. And so we want to be really thoughtful about how we allow these things to change our behavior. To me, it's really interesting to run an asset allocation through the system and see what your expected return is in any given year. But I wouldn't want to say that because your return expectation went up by 30 basis points this year or went down by 50 basis points another year, that that would mean you should do things like, say, adjust your actuarial assumed rate. And I know that's not the purview of this board, but these are the types of questions that groups grapple with because sometimes it feels like, well, things are changing. We need to adjust how we're managing portfolios. And I think rather we should take the information to say, what are we seeing in the capital markets now? And then how can we use that information to better manage the portfolio and make decisions over the long run? So just wanted to highlight that. And in that context on 35, what you see our return expectations, so these are based on Makita's capital market assumptions 10 years ago. The blue line is 2015. And then today, the green bar is 2025. And so, you know, sort of the tagline for this is that in general, you're getting a higher return for about the same level of risk in a portfolio, which means that the standard deviation numbers haven't changed dramatically across that 10-year period. But the return expectations have come up. Now, in some ways, this is relatively obvious, right?
We've seen yields rise. So that's true only in 2024 and 2025. Prior to that, you hadn't seen a huge increase in expectations for fixed income in many, many years. And then you also see somewhat higher return expectations across across equity markets, across real estate, et cetera. Private equity remains one of the higher expectations across these portfolios. I also want to note that these are based on 20-year assumptions. We're focused in your review today and when we get to the next couple of slides on the 10-year numbers, given the uncertainty that's out there and given how, I hate to use the word optimistic, but given how optimistic the 20-year returns feel in an environment that's very uncertain, we think that the 10-year numbers are a better reflection of data points that we can use to set an expectation for your portfolio to use in the capital market and asset allocation process.
Just quickly back on that slide. Yep. The 2015 was what the expectations were at that time. It is not updated for what actually happened.
No. And we do have actually a slide, and maybe we'll bring it to the May meeting since we'll bring you back your returns, where we actually show Makita's assumptions going back in time from when we started them and what the results actually were so that you can see. It's sort of fun. Okay. Maybe fun for me. I don't know if Frank would say fun, but I think it's sort of a fun slide. Okay. On 37, what we're doing here is just noting what we've done. So that was Makita's process for developing capital market assumptions and sort of where we sit today from our perspective. For your process, a lot goes into how we all want to work together to review your asset allocation and OPERF's portfolio and expectations among its specific and discrete asset categories. So Makita and Aon shared our capital market assumptions with Carl and Rex and your staff who reviewed them. Your staff developed their own set of assumptions as well alongside ours. So in a moment, I'll highlight for you those three sets of numbers. And then what we really ultimately ask for at the end of this process is for you to consider those three suites of numbers and to either pick one or an average of the three so that we can, for your May meeting, come back with inputting those numbers into the process and providing you some outputs. In terms of the asset classes that matter to you and your portfolio, we have public equity, which is a global perspective for the Oregon portfolios. Fixed income, this is used in a pretty traditional way in your portfolio. So the Bloomberg aggregate is kind of the base. That's your benchmark. Private equity, real estate, which is modified. And I want to note that this is very common. Makita can, Aon can, I'm sure as well. We can modify the assumptions or weight them in different ways to best reflect the underlying of your portfolios. That's one of the benefits of having 113 subcategories is we can take your core real estate and your non-core real estate and blend them together to make an OPERF specific real estate assumption. Within real assets, similarly, you can use infrastructure and natural resources to create an appropriate expectation. And then in diversifying strategies, we can create kind of a diversified basket. This is, I would argue, the most challenging category to predict. It has so many different types of strategies within it. There are so many variables that impact both the returns that you see, the types of risks that are present in these portfolios, that when we get to that number on the next slide, I would just want everyone to note that they look the most different between Makita, Aon, and your staff. And I think that's because there's the least certainty with respect to what builds that bucket up. Okay, so that brings us to 38, which is, again, the starting point for those inputs that would go into the model. So these were based on, again, discussions with the three groups, Makita, Aon, and staff. And you see two tables here, really, the expected returns on top and the volatility numbers beneath. A couple of things to note. You have Makita's numbers on the left, Aon's in the center, staff's are on the right. Broadly speaking, the numbers are reasonably close together. I think the largest areas of difference are, again, in real assets and diversifying strategies. And that really comes from, again, what builds up that component of the portfolio, right? Different types of real estate have different expected returns, different types of real assets, also infrastructure, natural resources, public, private. The mix of those things can really influence the return outcomes. So I wouldn't
take too much away from that, except for to note that depending on either which of these vertical lines you choose to use as inputs, or if you choose to blend them, just to be aware that there's more dispersion in those returns than in, for example, other areas like public fixed income, where we're all within, you know, 30-ish basis points of the same number over time. From a volatility standpoint, similarly, you see, I would say, a lot of consensus around the type of volatility we see in these different market categories. In a few areas, they're slightly different, but you see obviously a higher expected standard deviation among things like equities, private equity, even real assets, because that includes assets that are moved with public markets. And then you see, you know, lower volatility across areas like fixed income and diversifying strategies, where you expect there to be some volatility reducing components of those over time. So I wanted to pause on this slide in case there are questions. I don't know if Carl is in the room. I didn't get a perfect. So if there are questions for either Makita, Aon, staff, thoughts from the council, or questions about, you know, how these feed into the process. But if I recall, and Rex helped refresh my memory this morning, a few years ago, the last time we did this, you blended the three. So you just sort of took the average of the three returns, and we used that as the inputs. Other choices are to just have Makita run ours through the system. We can run Aon's through the system, or we can run staff's through the system. I don't know if you have.
Yeah, if I could add just one comment onto what Mika just said. I think historically speaking, one of the reasons why we have tended to blend the numbers is because I think Makita and Aon's numbers are more of a general generic number for all of your clients. Whereas I think staff number, we're trying to make adjustments. So for example, the real assets portfolio, we're looking for more sort of stable income generating type ideas rather than sort of growthier ideas, for example. So it's not to say that our number is more accurate. I think we all know that these numbers are really kind of suspect. But from a staff's perspective, we're trying to modestly adjust the numbers for our particular strategy.
And one other thing just to kind of keep in mind throughout this process is, as you sit today, your actuarial assumed rate of return is 6.9%. Actuaries tend to use the longest time frame, so 20 plus years feed into their results. So here we're looking at 10-year numbers. I will say I can't speak for Anne, although I can guess. All of our numbers are higher over 20 years, and that's part of why we're not showing them here, because you will easily meet your 6.9% objective with any of the 20-year assumptions baked in. I think that a lot could change over the next decade before that 11 to 20-year period. So to us, this is a reasonable time frame to be looking at today. But just as a little bit of a flash forward, based on the Makita inputs today, your expected return would be around 7.3% if we fed that through the model. So that just gives you a kind of a sense for where all these numbers shake out.
And when you say our actuarial rate, are you talking about?
Actually, our actuarial
okay.
rate.
Okay, yeah. That was the question.
Yeah. Yes, that is the actuarial rate that PERS has set. And then we have an expected go-forward return
that we have based on our last process. What is that number, if you have it on the top of your head, and how does that compare to the PERS 6.9?
You're testing my memory. I don't want to, because we used the 20-year numbers last time too, so I don't want to misspeak, but I can get that and circle back.
Okay,
I thought it was slightly above your assumed rate, but
same.
Yeah. I thought 2 years ago it was 7.6 for the,
4 years ago.
And now if you take the target allocations, you're dropping 7.6 by anywhere between 50 and 90 basis points based on the targets and running these numbers through it.
Yeah. And when we run these models, we base it on our target asset allocation as opposed to our actual.
Correct, to set so that you have an understanding of your target returns. We also can run, and many clients ask us to run your actual portfolio through as well, so that you can see the difference between current allocation and targeted allocation.
Yeah, if you recall, we had done the liquidity analysis based on your current and your target.
Yep, well, that was very helpful. Any questions from the council?
Just to put a finer point, the next meeting is sort of a bit of a joint meeting where the PERS board will be here and we'll talk a bit about how we do the assumed rate for liabilities. Matt and Scott from Milliman are here and they'll be presenting on our behalf. And then following that, in July of this year, the PERS board will set all the actuarial assumptions and methodologies for the next 2 years. And these numbers are very big input into the assumed rate of return that the board takes on.
So, Madam Chair, are we looking at, again, have appreciation, so thank you, Mika, looking to make a decision this process as well as the timing in May, correct in that? Well, I think it sounds like Mika is asking us for direction on which numbers to use. However, in the May meeting, they will come with refined numbers and they will have run scenario analysis with those returns to say, with these returns and this expected volatility, here is what you might expect. And then at that meeting, we will vote. So there's no vote today, but I think what I'm hearing you say is, how would you like us to run that? How would we like you to run that scenario kind of analysis?
Yes, that's where we'll say our expected return for your portfolio is 7.3, or and then over 20 years, it's 8.1. We'll show you all of that data, but the inputs create the outputs. And so that's the direction we're looking for at this meeting.
I want to make sure, Lorraine, just because you're virtual, that we're giving you an opportunity to speak and ask questions.
Thank you. On that point, I think I heard Mika say that the last time we ended up using the average of the consultants and staff rates. Is that correct?
Do you remember it the same way, Carl? Yeah, Carl, Rex, and I agree that's how we did
okay.
it.
Okay. That was my question, and I guess I would ask just for input if there's a recommendation from staff as to which rates we use. Obviously, there's a staff recommendation, but for our process, I'd be interested in Rex's thoughts.
I personally think just using the average captures a multitude of different opinions, which is sort of a little bit more of a general market, and then maybe specifying a little bit closer to the way that we're executing on these different asset classes. So I think the average makes a lot of sense, but again, I would just as a reminder, there just isn't a lot of precision here. Yeah. So we can use Makita's numbers or we could use the average, which is sort of the historical practice.
Based on machete math, it looks like the average is about 685. Yeah.
685.
If you take the three.
Over 10 years, then the number will be significantly higher over 20.
Yeah. I think the lack of precision actually is the argument for the average.
Kara, I'd like to make a motion that we use the average for these computations.
I second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Then we have voted on non-voting items. Great.
Any question to you, Mika, just from a diversification perspective and tying to what you're asking around, we're using our target allocations. Are we assuming static correlations when we're doing these, or do you model to allow for that correlation to increase during tail events? And how do you do that? I don't have any clue how that works.
It's a great question, and I can answer it, but since I have Frank on the line and I want him to have a chance to speak, I'll ask. Frank, did you hear the question around whether correlations are static or how they adjust during scenario testing?
Yes, I did hear the question. So I'll say that the correlations that are used for producing an expected return are static. But if you look at the way we actually model, the way we do our analysis for you, we run it through many different scenarios. We'll do simulation-based analysis, all of which is trying to get at what can actually happen in terms of worst-case returns. For example, when there is a GFC-like event where correlations all kind of spike and go towards one. So that's something you'll see in the modeling that we do for you.
It's effectively both. Yeah, you get to see the static correlations, but also how they adjust. And one thing that I will note, and thank you for the vote on the returns. So what we'll do is we'll use the average of the returns and the volatility. I would probably make the case, unless Aon or staff disagrees, that we just use Nikita's correlation. I don't know that blending correlations would be as effective in the process. So we'll just use those are standard into the input. Okay, to make sure we all agreed. And the other thing I wanted to note, when we come back to the May meeting and we run this portfolio, and this is one other place that I just wanted to make sure that we're clear if there is additional direction from the council, it's our assumption that given that next year we'll do that broader asset liability review, that at this stage for 2025, we'll look at your current portfolio and really focus on that and how the scenarios affect this portfolio without adding an additional layer of considering changes to the portfolio in the near term, that those would be considered potentially next year. But if there is a difference of opinion, I just wanted to give the opportunity to share that.
But I would say if we can look at both our target allocation and our current allocation, so we can see how that changes the expectations, if at all. And also, we will never be right on our target allocation. The actual allocation in our ranges will change based on.
Great. Well, we're happy to answer any additional questions, but I appreciate the feedback, and it's been a good dialogue so far.
Go ahead.
Just a comment that if I could, Madam Chair, I think for anybody listening, and maybe perhaps particularly for our colleagues in the legislature who are unlikely to listen to this but should be, you know, what this conversation points out is the challenge of predicting and the challenge of knowing. And to repeat something I said in a different conversation the other day, it's important to remember that results are always seen in retrospect and expectations are always seen in prospect, right? And you can't make plans based on, definitive plans based on a range like this. You can do your best, and our team really does its best. It does really, really well, and this is really challenging work. When you have three respected groups coming up with numbers that are varying as widely as, I mean, if you look at real assets, expected returns anywhere from 7.0 to 9.2%, that's a really significant variation between three groups of people who think about this stuff a lot and do very well at thinking about it. So I just think that's an important thing to put on the record as a reminder to everybody, honestly.
I have a question. What is the process, or what will you all do if a triggering event should happen, like 2008 or 2022? How will we be notified, updated? What would that look like?
So typically we would share with your staff and with you all if we were going to update our capital market assumptions, particularly if it happens while the process is being undertaken. I will say that, let's say we go through this process in May and we're all comfortable with the scenarios. We've used the 2025 inputs. We have not made adjustments. And then in September, the markets deteriorate or improve to such a degree that we adjust those expectations. At that point, I think we would view it as an informational item. I wouldn't recommend going back through this process, knowing that you have another process in 2026, and again, knowing that these numbers shift every year. So I would view it as sharing with you that we've undertaken that. We can always share the numbers, but we wouldn't redo your process simply based on a change to expectations. If it happens 2 weeks from now and it would inform your May meeting, I think we would want to come back to you with how that would impact these
And if I could maybe state it in a slightly different way, and this is supposed to be a strategic discussion, a long-term perspective. Allowing short-term market activity might start to make this process feel a little bit tactical in nature.
More than anything, and then Alan, I was just wanting to understand how, not that we would redo a process, but is that something we would even be notified of, right, when you have changing expectations? And make sure that we would, so that we have an understanding of what's going on, but not that we would then reallocate our portfolio. Go ahead, Alan.
Well, it really goes directly to that issue, and that is we, your staff, and your consultants report to you on a regular basis. If something changes, it's our obligation to bring that to your attention. Whether or not you choose to take action, that's really a policy decision, not an implementation decision. But we work for you. So if you collectively say, hey, we think the world's changed, we run the model using different assumptions, that's totally doable. You may not choose to take any action, but you might want that as part of the information, both for you and for the stakeholders. But we work for you, so it's not us saying, oh, the world has changed. It's listening to you, the client.
Anyone else have any questions or comments for Makita, for Frank, for Rex, before we move on to the next topic? Okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
We will move right into our OPERF Real Assets review of the Real Assets team and Axia. Come up. Ben, I will let you introduce yourself and our consultants.
Should I? There it goes. All right. Sorry, we got these new microphones, so apologies if it looks like I'm not exactly sure how to manage them. Well, good morning, everyone.
Project. Yes.
Okay. I'll try. I took a theater class in college. I will try that. Well, the next topic for discussion is the Real Assets Portfolio Annual Review and Plan. For the record, I'm Ben Mahon, Senior Investment Officer for the Real Assets Portfolio. I'm joined by two members of the portfolio's consulting team, Melissa Grant and Michael Brand, co-head of Real Assets at Axia. And this is their first time joining me, so I wanted to give them an opportunity to introduce themselves.
Thanks a lot, Ben. So nice to meet you guys. So Michael Brand, I'm a co-head of Real Assets at Axia. I joined about 6 months ago, came from Mercer, where I was global head of Real Assets there. And prior to that was at Cambridge Associates, where I was deputy head of Real Assets. So nice to meet you.
I've been at the firm for... I've been at the firm for 4+ years, working with some of our larger U.S. public pension clients on their portfolio construction for Real Assets. And prior to joining the firm, spent a decade at various private equity and infrastructure general partners.
Just, I apologize, before we move on, I'm less worried about the people that are virtual because you have a microphone. It's actually the people in the room because your back is towards them and it's a whisper. So if you could all just speak loudly, it would be greatly appreciated.
I'll try my best. If you need the volume up, just give me it. Hey, that's okay. You know, I'm coaching my daughter's softball team, so I'm used to yelling. So I will try to use that as inspiration. So starting on page 2, this is the agenda for the presentation. We've linked the investment beliefs from the investment policy statement, and X's just signify where the beliefs are featured prominently. So asset allocation, diversification, private markets, cost and alignment, ESG and D&I considerations, all enumerated in policy and all of which serve to guide strategy, portfolio construction, manager selection decisions for the portfolio. On the next slide, we see this in action. Starting with background, as noted, the portfolio was seeded with 3 investments from the Opportunity Portfolio in July 2011, so almost 14 years old now. And consistent with the expansion potential outlined in the original proposal, the target allocation for the portfolio has increased since inception from what was initially sub 5%, 7.5% today. As of the end of third quarter, the actual allocation is 10.7% or $10.3 billion in NAV, so over target and just outside of the prescribed allocation range. We'll go into greater detail into some of the drivers, but the increase has been driven by a strong period of performance. For context, the market value as of 9/30/2020, 4 years ago, was just under $5 billion, 6.1% of OPERF. So the portfolio has more than doubled over that period. And that's the majority of that, two-thirds is from capital appreciation. The other third is from net cash flow as the portfolio has been ramping up, contributing more than we've been receiving in distributions. So not even though we are making efforts to guide the portfolio back to target allocation, I'd rather it be over allocation for that reason. Portfolio objectives are laid out on the left, but to summarize, primary objective of the real assets portfolio is to provide a source of diversification for OPERF. That's through seeking less correlated and diversifying sources of return, as well as inflation-sensitive returns. We see that reflected in the benchmark as well, CPI plus 4 benchmark. That inflation-sensitive bit is especially relevant in the recent market environment. For the decade ended 2020, inflation averaged 1.7% annualized. 2021 and 2022, CPI was 7%, the highest levels since late 70s, early 80s. That leads me to performance, which is summarized on the table at the bottom. As mentioned, portfolios had a strong 5-year period of performance, and now outperforming the benchmark since inception. Overall, please, portfolio performed the way that it did. Reality is our portfolio has never been through an inflationary period before. So in an environment, high inflation, central bank tightening, weighing on all financial assets, causing correlations between assets to increase, the returns demonstrate the portfolio attributes of a real assets allocation. And 2022 was really the litmus test. S&P was down 18%. Bloomberg Aggregate was down 13%. This portfolio was up 14%, led by natural resources, which was up 25%.
Quick question, just squaring the numbers on that.
Mm-hmm.
The CPI plus 4, you mentioned 2021, 2022, 7% CPI, but I'm seeing CPI plus 4 at 8.5-ish. Is that because you're averaging in an inflation of 2 or 2.7 or whatever it was in the other years in those?
Exactly.
All right. Thank you.
And this is as of 9/30/2, so it would be not exactly. My calendar year statement's not exactly aligning with the trailing periods. Slide 4 takes a high-level view of exposures for the portfolio. There's two things to note. First, in the portfolio summary table in the upper left, the numbers are what you expect. It's still a relatively young portfolio, even though I mentioned it's now in its teenage years. The consistent pacing was really more a feature of the past 10 years. So we would expect those attributes to grow. Second would be the diversification across the portfolio. As shown by the table and pie charts, real assets portfolio is broadly diversified across managers, sectors, and geographies. We have some additional background on secular themes in the following slides. But the biggest changes to the portfolio's sector exposures have been the increases to digital infrastructure and energy transition infra or renewable energy on here. Both are up from essentially 0 7 years ago to the two largest sectors today. And that's really a reflection of GP's strategy evolving with the opportunity set as opposed to any type of top-down mandate. In particular, we see OPERF managers participating fully in energy transition themes. To date, the highest quality energy transition exposures have come from traditional energy managers who benefit from their experience and relationships in the sector. And important to note, while I often differentiate the infra and natural resources exposures, we treat as one portfolio. And energy transition is an example of a theme that blurs the lines between the two sectors, and we feel puts the real assets portfolio in a better position to execute. For example, the transition to a net zero economy will be metal intensive, so having a view of the entire ecosystem is really valuable. So this is going.
Sorry, I have asked this every single meeting, but back on that, can you just let everyone know which of the sectors are considered infrastructure versus natural resources? Because some of them could be both.
That's right. So we, and even just to take a step back.
Sorry.
Okay. I'll move.
In the room, it only helps for.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's a mic for the folks virtually. My mic helps, but I'm really not.
Okay. to answer your question.
just 1 second, Ben. Some of that might be the microphone volume as well. So we just turned up the volume.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you.
We do have our own. So, Kara, to your point, we, with each good. So it was just the microphone volume. Okay. Yes. I was talking very loud. We have a custom sector classification scheme. So we look through our underlying portfolio companies and we classify them into these sectors that are more relevant than, say, a public equity using GICS or other custom or other classification schemes. So it's a little, again, it's a little gray, your point. It could be, you could kind of classify it as one or the other. But if you just look at the agriculture, energy upstream, metals and mining, and timberland, that would be our natural resources exposure. Okay. And that was Jamie had suggested I add maybe blow it out so it makes it more clear what is natural resources, what is infrastructure. Because we don't have targets to those sectors, I didn't want to overemphasize.
Yeah.
It's how that works, but so today it's about 25% of the portfolio is in natural resources. In our target, it's about a third. So,
and Ben, if I'm not mistaken, that ratio was almost flipped the other way.
10 years ago, the target was completely inverse, and it's really a reflection of the growth of infrastructure as the asset class.
And we do owe Ben an apology because it was obviously the microphone. I apologize.
Okay.
Because he was yelling at Mike.
Okay. So key takeaways on slide 5. I describe as a steady period of performance. All four quarters for the past year were positive. In fact, the last negative quarter was Q1 2020. So 18 consecutive quarters with a positive return. And I call out the recent energy vintages because they've been very strong contributors. That portfolio would be top quartile in the manager peer universe. And it's also our top 7 performing funds are in that cohort. And those were dark times, not the easiest period to commit capital, but reflects good manager selection and the value of consistent pacing. So the SITS inception IRR stands at 7.6%, now outperforming the benchmark. In terms of commitment pacing, received 6 approvals. Last year, all re-ups or co-investment with existing relationships, totaling $775 million. That was on the lower end of our revised pacing plan, but in line with our expectations as we tried to guide to really know more than a billion. In general, real assets exhibit lumpier deal flow, so we expect some range in any single calendar year, but continuing to guide that range down. What was historically $1.5 to $2 billion, we decreased to 1 to 1.5 last year, and further $500 million to $1 billion this year. We expect that rolling average to settle closer to the $1 billion target. In terms of co-investment, the program continues to go well. We've had $1.5 billion in commitments over the past 4 years. Now that portfolio is diversified across 73 underlying co-investments. And as you recall, our strategy here, it's about fee mitigation. We're trying to get exposure to as many deals as we can. So that 73 is a good number. Co-investment represented 29% of commitments in 2024. and that's been extremely consistent the past 4 years. We expect that to come down over time as the initial wave of these vehicles, as we structure those relationships, ebbs, but still seeing a lot of opportunities. Final bullet points, portfolio maturation. The portfolio is settling into a really good spot. Exposures are where we'd want them, well-diversified across managers, sectors, assets, and risk profiles. And in a milestone, 2024 was the first calendar year of positive net cash flow, just under $360 million of positive net cash flow with $1.37 billion of distributions. We expect those, as we get into the pacing and some cash flow modeling, we expect those distributions to grow in the coming years. I didn't add a bullet point on this slide, but while it's me presenting, everything in the deck is the culmination of a lot of collective efforts all across OST. It's specific to the portfolio team, and they're behind me, Paul, Amanda, Faith, Ian. Mike's not behind me. He's on vacation, but he's here in spirit. Over the past 3 years, past three calendar years, including the real assets portfolio and the diversifying strategies portfolio, the team has received approval for over 40 investments, totaling $8 billion in capital. 2024 marked a number of major transformations events. I mentioned portfolio maturity is one, as we've really shifted from what was primarily sourcing, underwriting, to more monitoring. Those are related but different skill sets. And the second would be, and I think we've managed through that very effectively, the second would be the transitioning of the oversight of the diversifying strategies portfolio to Tim Kaine, the new diversifying strategies SIO. The alternatives portfolio IOs have always played a unique role in that they have overseen historically two very different portfolios, two very different stages of development. Starting in 2020, that went into overdrive as we completely reconfigured the DSP portfolio. And I think the team just deserves all the credit for the success of that program. So maybe that the handoff may be a little bittersweet. Like, honestly, it's more sweet than bitter given the workload. The transition really went off without a hitch. And that's a testament to the quality of the portfolio, the quality of the process, and the focus on teamwork. So I'll pause there. There's always a bit of thunder stealing on that slide because those are the key takeaways. But happy to answer any questions, and if not, we can delve into some of the market slides. Okay.
Just reiterate Ben's comments. The portfolio performance has been fantastic, and has managed to stay that way through managing two completely different portfolios and then the handoff of one. So great job to you and to the team.
Thank you. So maybe as we transition to the markets slides, I'll start by just addressing the market volatility elephant in the room. S&P is down 9% year to date. There have been 4 days with moves greater than 3%. Actually, three of those were negative 3% moves. And in terms of implications for private markets and for the real assets portfolio, consensus is very clearly it's too soon to know much around those specifics and too soon to draw any thematic ideas that can be applied. I think I did a word search on my inbox and lack of clarity was the most common phrase. And it's been fascinating to me that really the past few weeks, we have not received a lot of commentary from our private markets managers, at least me personally. And I think it's just a reflection of that. It's just a little too uncertain to make definitive statements. We actually saw a few deal announcements, two big acquisitions last week, one big monetization this week. Granted, those processes had started before April 2nd, but still found that to be an interesting anecdote. So the next four slides cover market themes. And so these are themes that I find interesting and also have a big impact on our portfolio. So it's digitalization, specifically the growth of AI, decarbonization, specifically the investment needs and headwinds related to the energy transition, and lastly, commodities and some of the specific supply and demand pressures in those markets. So starting with digital infrastructure, there's been a step change in ship performance and a related step change in power consumption. I just thought this was an interesting anecdote. The average electricity demand of a typical search using ChatGPT consumes 10 times more electricity than a Google search. That's maybe not the most relevant stat, but I think it's just illustrates the when we talk about AI and power demand, there's a great example. And then on the bottom left, after decades of flat load growth, we're seeing meaningful growth projections. And I highlight data centers, but it's growing across sectors. Electrification of household appliances, your heat pumps, EVs, hydrogen production, and maybe increasingly onshoring manufacturing. And that demand for data center capacity is driven by cloud services as organizations migrate their data from on-site services to the cloud and AI. And that's led to a continued growth in data center leasing, with power constraints driving a sharp reversal of pricing trends in the past years. I call out data centers because they are the largest infra asset category, representing about 8% of the portfolio, but the theme impacts other asset types from fiber optic cables to 5G networks, as well as power generation. Next, please feel free to chime in if there was ever anything to add. So these top two charts on this slide consider the demand and supply for energy. And I have a quote there, but really the message is the transition has really been one of energy addition. Forecasts for global energy demand vary, but one of the constants is the world is going to need a lot more energy with meaningful contribution from all sources. There's 8 billion people on Earth today. It's estimated another 2 billion will be added over the course of the next three decades. Energy demand is projected to grow more strongly in emerging economies, driven by rising prosperity and living standards. As people move from low to middle income, their energy consumption increases by 135%. Then from middle to high income, it's another 225%. So that's this lucky billion on the left. That's the aspiration of, you know, the rest of the world. And so that's why this is an EIA projection, increasing consumption across all sources there in the upper right. It's a 1% CAGR for fossil fuels and a 3% CAGR for renewables. And that requires a lot of investment. And specific to the renewable portion on the bottom left, energy transition investment passed the $1 trillion mark in 2021. In 2024, it was $2.1 trillion. But to get on track for net zero, energy transition and grid investment need to average $5.6 trillion between 2025 and 2030, nearly triple what was spent in 2024. And by 2036, those investment requirements total $7.8 trillion, nearly four times 2024 levels. So a lot of private capital required and a lot of investment opportunities. And also a recognition that the energy transition is going to play out over decades, not years. I think actually China is number one in that category. This is global. So it'd be China and the U.S. would be one and two.
India?
Not sure where they fit. I can get you a more precise breakout.
Ben, maybe just teasing too, when we talk about performance, you certainly have seen the beneficiaries of this energy demand kind of flow through the public markets too, with utilities probably being one of the biggest beneficiaries. So historically, they've been kind of known as just like very boring, kind of plodding along. You've always seen kind of flat electricity demand. And in the last, you know, maybe 18 months or so, you're actually now seeing a pickup in demand for electricity, and that's flowed through to the public markets in a big way. So it's connecting utilities to some of these mega trends, which, you know, we'll flag in the performance, but it really has provided a big tailwind in the public markets, which will likely flow through to the private markets as well.
I almost included that chart, but if you plot NVIDIA's stock price against some independent power producers, it's very highly correlated. So that's this interconnection that I think has been a real theme the past few years for the real asset sector.
I could also add there's a pretty big bottleneck as well, though.
That's an excellent segue.
Rex, can you repeat that? We didn't.
I was just saying that some of the conversations around utilities, there's also sort of a bottleneck happening there as well.
So, and that'll be actually the bottom half of this slide addresses that exact thing, the bottleneck around specifically electric transmission infrastructure.
The other thing that I'm hearing, and maybe this isn't the right time to address it, especially when you're thinking, but given this, a lot of jurisdictions, both within the United States, I mean, it's happening in Hillsborough, are banning the new data centers because of energy consumption issues. And I'm assuming that that's something that you all are going to have to take into consideration as you think about all this. And I do think that, I'm starting to hear some stuff about increase in activity in site-specific energy production, you know, high-pressure natural gas or whatever, to power local turbines for this kind of stuff. So I'm just, at some point, I'd be curious to know how you all are thinking about that, because I do think that's going to be an issue, and it ties in with this correlation, this issue here, I think.
Absolutely. No, that's for sure a very topical. I'm actually, after this presentation, I'm going to a conference, and the topic is, I'm moderating a panel on AI, the infrastructure play, and those are the key issues. Data centers, very power intensive, very water intensive, and you are seeing that's increasing. We haven't, it's, I think, more smoke than fire at this point, but co-locating these data centers with maybe nat gas, or now even with nuclear, and pursuing other more emerging technologies, SMRs being the most, getting the most headlines. But it's all a great segue, because it is, I think our job is really separating that narrative, the opportunity narrative, to the investment reality. And this, the chart on the upper left looks at the performance of clean energy stocks over the past 4 years, and it's just been, they've just been decimated, a terrible slump. The global equities returned 66% over that period versus clean energy down 80%. And you had, as inflation rose, interest rates rose in response. You had higher cost of capital as well as rising OPEX and CAPEX, and that just hit profit growth expectations. If you were to look at the prior 4 years, that clean energy index had just skyrocketed, and that the bubble burst, I think, once some of the realities set in. That these were there were commercial risks, there were technology risks, as regulatory risks, as those sort of became exposed. I added that red diamond, and apologies, it's a little hard to see. That is the real asset portfolio's renewable energy performance. It was a 1.6x return as of 9/30. So very different experience than the public markets, and I think that's not surprising. First off, we have invested over this period, from 2019 to the day, what was a $400 million portfolio is now a $2.2 billion portfolio. So 5x type growth, and that's diversified across battery storage and renewable generation and EV charging. It's just a very different exposure than what you see in the public markets. Not taking tech risk. These are often, while there is often some development component, they're also operating assets, contracted, proven technologies, commercially scalable. And Rex alluded to this too, in addition to some of all those factors I just mentioned, there are additional headwinds from higher systems costs and inadequate electric transmission infrastructure. So there's been a recognition that intermittent renewable energy is actually very expensive for the system. Some more popular measures of cost ignore intermittency or non-dispatchability. So that chart on the right looks at the full system cost, serving the entire market with just one source of energy plus storage. And you see that in your utility bills. There's a near perfect correlation between renewable capacity and cost. Now to the bottom half. The net zero scenario requires increasing global renewables capacity threefold by 2030.
And this is the grid bottleneck that Rex alluded to. There are now more solar wind projects awaiting grid connection than there are existing solar wind projects. I've often borrowed the Treasurer Reed's. I think we've heard of NIMBYism, and that's a real challenge for the development of, no one wants a high transmission, high voltage transmission line in their backyard. And he calls it, he used the term bananaism, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything. And I think that's a real binding constraint. And so that energy transition will be stifled if the current pace of grid development does not accelerate. It's sort of the takeaway there.
The real-time example, all of my neighbors are going to protest PGE running additional lines in our neighborhood because they don't want them. But I would argue we probably consume more energy than most people in the world.
Yeah.
So right in our neighborhood.
Yeah.
So it's real.
Exactly. The next two slides look at natural resources. I'm cognizant of time, so I'll try to get through these quickly. But starting with traditional energy, it's almost the mirror image of clean energy. With demand consistent, supply pressures flow through to rising prices. And even in a rapid decarbonization scenario, because of the natural decline of current production, substantial oil and gas investment and new production will be needed for several decades. You can see the delta of current production and what's required. The IEA estimates that $7 trillion of incremental oil and gas CapEx is needed through 2050 to support the net zero by 2050 projections. And at the same time, now I'm on the bottom half, the sector is experiencing significant underinvestment, capital scarcity. Both E&P IPO volume and private equity dry powder down approximately 80%. And then the sector itself is in ultra capital discipline mode to win over investors. So tight with this management of investment. In that growth area or growth era of 2010, 2016, E&Ps were reinvesting more than they were earning, over 100% of EBITDA into CapEx. In this return of capital era, the last 3 years, it's been 41%. So no evidence that those trends will reverse anytime soon. And lastly, on the market side, the shift from a fuel-intensive to a material-intensive energy system implies a significant increase in the demand for minerals. To reach the goals of the Paris Agreement would mean a quadrupling of mineral inputs by 2040. Bloomberg estimates almost $10 trillion of metals could be needed between now and 2050 for the energy transition. So where does this demand come from? Typical electric car requires 6 times the mineral inputs of a conventional car. An onshore wind plant requires 9 times more mineral resources than a gas-fired power plant. And in these climate-driven scenarios, mineral demand for use in EVs and battery storage is a major force, growing at least 30 times by 2040. If you see that in terms of lithium, it's probably one of the highest profile, just given the growth there. But it's graphite, cobalt, nickel, copper. And in the bottom right, it raises huge questions about the availability and reliability of supply. China dominates energy transition materials. And so we're seeing that now. I've included this chart the last few years, but now we're really seeing that in the forefront, the geopolitical considerations and trade-offs that come into play. So I think, so that's it on the market slide. And the feedback I've got in the past is you should really put that in the appendix because it takes too long. So apologies if that consume too much of the time.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Those are the key thoughts. That's how we spend our day. So these are the approvals for the year. Again, it was $775 million in authorized commitments across 8 approvals. 29% was co-investment. We have one anchor investment that was Stone Peak 5. We have 2 specialist commitments. That was Lotus 4 and Stone Peak Global Renewables Fund 2. And then the 3 co-invest top-offs. This slide summarizes cash flow activity since inception. A lot of information, but the message is activity is as expected. For 2024, We had contributions of $1 billion versus distributions of $1.37 billion. So that was that net cash flow of $357 million. That narrowly missed the record for the record for the most distributions in a year. 2022 had $1.43 billion. And I'd highlight 2022 contributions. We had committed about $1 billion to open-ended funds, continuation vehicles, and co-investment. And these funds draw the entire commitment at one time, so effectively a one-time outflow. And absent those drawdowns, net cash flow would have been positive in 2022 to the tune of $100 million. So when we look at the pacing discussion to follow, it's, I think, a little more, the trajectory's been consistent. This slide looks at vintage year exposure for the portfolio over time. Still a younger portfolio, like 70% of the funds, vintage years 2018 and younger, a weighted average age of 6 years. And this is probably, I'm sorry I just keep including like confusing slides, but this is an important one. We bucket our portfolio a number of ways, one of which is risk. And so here we use the real estate nomenclature, core, core plus, value add, opportunistic. And the starting point for us is our performance objective is CPI plus 4%. Kind of back in historically, that's been a 7-9% range. So that's sort of our net return target. Translates to 10-12% gross return. So we have to take some risk. But the early in the portfolio's life, you could see it was just dominated by some of those riskier strategies. That was really a reflection of the market at the time. Private investors viewed infrastructure often as competing with private equity for capital. So these funds sort of marketed those higher returns, took more risk. So the key theme for us, but that really thing starts to deviate from the objective if you have all that equity risk. So the key theme for us really the past 5 years has been de-risking or improving quality of the portfolio. And some of that was just letting the opportunity emerge as there weren't many core plus funds in the market. So added, as I mentioned, some of those open-ended core funds, and then also within natural resources, more funds that have either seniority in terms of the cash flows or just lower risk, more developed assets. Okay. I will hand it over to Axia for a conversation on performance and pacing. Just to explain these tables, the top table you're looking at, the total portfolio versus the policy benchmark, the CPI plus 4, as well as the Burgess manager universe. So this looks at all the real estate funds and pulls those together to generate a return. And then the second two boxes just do the same, but for the infrastructure component and the natural resources component.
All right, so I will keep this generally pretty high level because I think the theme pervades throughout that, you know, the portfolio has done very well. So general outperformance. I guess the one thing I would tease or kind of pay off maybe from what I teased earlier, if you look in the second chart, just the S&P Global Infrastructure Index is one of the benchmarks that we use on the public side. You can see that outperformance on the public side really flowed through in 2024. Again, that being a reflection of just the strength of utilities, reflecting the demand for electricity, as well as just the growth driver that data centers really brought to the market last year. So, you know, certainly that's not a sustainable level of return. And, you know, certainly public, private investments are, you know, a little bit more kind of like slow and steady win the race. So we would expect that to converge over time, but just certainly wanted to call that out as maybe the, you know, the most glaring outlier on this page. But generally speaking, solid performance, solid outperformance against, you know, nearly every benchmark on the page. And then on this page, we just look through to performance by vintage year. So I think that the big takeaway here is just to flag really since, you know, call it 2015, you've seen a pretty marked, you know, change in just outperformance on a quartile basis. So, you know, certainly before 2015 was a little bit more volatile as it relates to just, you know, quartile outcomes. You know, that certainly has stabilized and, you know, certainly has become kind of more, you know, above median across the board ever since then, really underscoring a lot of what Ben had talked about as it relates to, you know, how they built the portfolio, how they focus on manager selection, you know, building that proper risk return mix within the portfolio, as well as just being focused on, you know, some of the overall objectives as it relates to what real assets does for your portfolio.
On that one, the commitment, that's what we ended up committing, or what the approval was, what's left in there, what is that number?
Sure. The in prior slides, the commitment is when it was authorized.
Yeah.
And in this, it's the actual vintage year of the fund. That's where the commitment goes to. So say we got approval for a fund in 2023, but they didn't call capital until 2024, it would be a 2024 vintage year.
Oh, okay.
So those are the actual commitments. And in some instances, we got the approval for $100 million. They only gave us $75 million of capacity. Then that would be on the approval slide, it would say 100. On this slide, it would say 75.
So that's how much cash was laid out in the year, regardless of when it was approved.
It was not the cash that was contributed, but it was the commitment. It was
accepted. I thought you just said the opposite.
So 2023 reflects those funds that have a vintage year of 2023, and that was the total commitment that was from us that was accepted.
Okay, not what we...
Not the year that we got it approved.
And so just to add to that, when committing to a closed-ended drawdown vehicle, we would expect the entirety of the commitment to be drawn into the fund over the course of the investment period, which could be 3 years.
Okay. That's why I'm asking the question, actually. Because what I'm trying to understand is this how much was approved in the year? Or is this how much capital was called and sent in the year? Because I understand that those are two different things.
Yeah, and it's actually a third thing.
Okay, so what is that?
Every fund gets assigned a vintage year, and that based on when they first called
capital. How much cash was outlaid for that vintage year in when?
So perhaps a perfect segue to pacing. So if we look at the capital that was outlaid in 2022, for example, if within there, we'll use round numbers, there was $100 million committed to a particular fund, we would expect within a degree of rounding about $20 to be called in 2022, $50 to be called in 2023, and about $30 to be called in the subsequent year.
I understand that.
So maybe I can...
What are you showing in this column?
Okay, so if I can maybe try it.
Yeah.
Okay, so as Ben said, there are three different ways to look at this. So there is our approval date, which goes into our sort of calculation of our vintage year pacing. But when we actually approve the fund does not necessarily mean that that's when the first amount of capital is called. So what Ben is defining here is when was that first amount called, not the full amount of each year, but defining there's a difference between when we approve it and when the actual vintage year of a fund is, because there's a capital raising. And then the third part is each year there's a different amount that's called. So this is number two, where the vintage year is actually being defined as not our approval date, but the vintage date of the fund itself. That's all.
Thank you.
And so to turn to pacing, just quickly, we run a pacing analysis for the portfolio at least on an annual basis, which sets parameters for capital requirements for the coming years. Just broadly, our model that we use at Axia is based on the Takahashi Alexander, or better known as the Yale model, which takes the current holdings in the portfolio and projects out the future based on the assumptions for each of those various holdings, and then layers in potential future commitments to to project the exposure of the whole portfolio, or the real assets portfolio rather, relative to the entire plan over the course of a 10 or so year period. One other anecdote, just important to look at pacing on more of a longer term view as opposed to a precise prediction at any specific point in time. And so looking out over the course of the next 9 or so years, we would anticipate targeting about $750 million in annual commitments. We typically put a range around that, so somewhere between half a billion and $1 billion versus prior years, which had much larger commitments, and that's for a number of reasons. The kind of primary reason for that is some of the open-ended or evergreen investments that have been committed to in the most recent years, which would expect to continue to recycle capital. So wouldn't be in that headline 750, but rather capital within the portfolio that's going to continue to be allocated and reallocated, as well as the over allocation of the portfolio that we're currently seeing. And so we can see here the glide path of the base case, assuming 750 million of annual commitments to continue to decrease somewhat and be within the target range in the coming years.
Hunter? This is a little bit of a 101 question, but I'm still in my first 6 months, so I'm still allowed to ask 101 questions. Given the performance of this portfolio over the past umpteen years, when do we start to consider what our reconsider what our target ranges are for asset allocation? Because, I mean, and this may not be an appropriate question for this meeting, and if so, we can talk about it offline or somewhere else, but or at another time. But it does make me wonder, if we're getting these excess returns and doing so well, why are we looking to decrease our allocation in this, especially at a time like this when there's so much volatility in other asset classes? And this, as I said, it's a 101 question, people. So,
Madam Treasurer, I'll try first. Generally speaking, people in our business are totally adverse to making tactical decisions because the cost of being wrong is so high and there's no upside. There's just no upside to making bets. There will be a review when you do your big asset allocation next year, where if the expectation for the asset class continues to be greater than other asset classes, that you can make a choice to increase strategically. But we would urge you never to be tactical, because the upside is doesn't cover you for the negative result.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
And the asset class ranges will be reviewed through the investment policy statement review, as well as the asset allocation and asset liability study. So we can revisit the plus or minus 5% ranges.
Great. Thank you very much.
I would add to that that it was not very long ago that we increased the target for this portfolio from 5% to 7.5%, which 2.5% doesn't feel like a lot, but it's a 50%
lot. It's a lot. No, that's a lot. Yeah. I totally agree. That's a lot. Okay, thank you. This was all very helpful.
And there's even a more, from a more of a practical perspective, for the, I don't know, this is like the 10th or 11th year I've given this presentation. For the prior 9 years, the questions were, why aren't you a target? Are you ever going to get to target? What's it going to take? And so there is... it's just a smaller market, and so I think practically there are some constraints on how realistically how big you can grow the portfolio. Now, there are plans, especially our friends to the north, that have much larger allocations to infrastructure, but they invest directly in many cases. And it was also, I thought you took that, Carrie, you took your comment a different direction, where I thought 4 years ago, it was the performance picture was very different. And so, and it, granted, it was a younger portfolio. But that's one reason I think I've been maybe emphasizing performance in this most recent period, is because I had to
take the arrows when it was not as good. So I think that's another consideration too. It's just a younger asset class. And so it's a little relative to real estate, to private equity, you don't quite have the history and through the market cycles. So a larger allocation just requires a little bit more faith.
All very helpful. Thank you very much.
Can I actually ask another? This is just for consideration, but this pacing analysis assumes a base case that the pension overall grows at 2%. And we just got done discussing our expected return is around 7.
This is net of cash flows. So pension payments.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And so just to conclude on pacing on slide 19, this shows the projected cash flows for the portfolio based on the assumptions of what is currently in the portfolio, as well as the additional $750 million on an annual basis. So high level would expect the portfolio to remain cash flow positive as distributions will outpace required contributions. All that being said, imperative to maintain consistent deployment and pacing to enable the projection of future behaviors of this portfolio.
And I think Mr. Olenek is going to hold you to your words there. So we're going to get positive distributions.
I think in the interest of time, there was just one for these are next year priorities. I just wanted to flag and actually, you guys can cover your ears, but they're at the end of their agreement. It expires at the end of this calendar year. So we do expect to issue the RFP on May 1st. It's in with procurement and in the legal review process. So we would target, I think responses are due in mid-July, and we would like to come back in October. And so we'll be through that process. And it's just a little unknown till we get the responses, exactly how that process unfolds, but we'll be communicative through that. Generally, it depends on how we've done it differently different years, but if we want to consider an OIC participation in that, OIC member participation. That's the end of the formal remarks.
Comments, questions, Alan?
Very quickly, when you go back to the pacing, that's the expected. There's a range around the expected, so you could end up with something very different as you experienced in the past. And so I just want to make it clear, that's not a Bible. You don't know that it's going to happen.
Very true.
Having the consultants at the front is already paying off. Anything else? Okay, we are going to take a quick break. We're running a few minutes behind on time. We can have the real estate team queue up at the front. When we get back, let's say, we'll just do 10:40.
Thank you, everyone.
I am going to turn it over to Gloria Gill, and I will let you introduce the other speakers. Go ahead.
Good morning, Treasurer Steiner, Chair Samples, and members of the OIC committee. I'm Gloria Gill, Senior Investment Officer. It's my second year, almost 2 years now at OSD. A brief background, 10 years at La Sera, 15 years at UC Regents, and here at OSD. And to my left is Christy Fields, our great consultant for many years. And to my right, I want to introduce my team, because I think the success of this portfolio has really been the seasoned team that you have. And so start with Austin.
Hey, good morning. Austin Carmichael with the real estate team.
And Chris Ebersole. Good morning.
And we also promoted Taylor Bowman in the audience. Where is she? She's going for our executive MBA, will be done by the year end. And also training our new analyst, Tara Curran, also in the back. And for the first time, real estate is complete, so I'm proud to say. I will start with Christy will start with a high level, and then I'll tee it off, and Austin and Chris will take over.
Thank you, Gloria. Nice to be here again. When I was here last year, I believe I shared with you the mantra that was popular in the real estate industry last year, that was stay alive till 25. People were anticipating a return to more normal transaction volumes That sentiment was kind of buoyed by expectation of a decrease in interest rates and an end to the transactional drought that started in 2022. But that hasn't exactly rolled out that way. And like Yogi Berra said, the future ain't what it used to be.
Yes.
And so although we did see a slight increase in transaction volumes in the first quarter of this year, the last month has really, with the new administration and some of the new policies primarily around tariffs and immigration, really has the real estate industry kind of pausing again and find it quite difficult to parse the daily news and develop conviction around new real estate investment decisions. So today, folks in the real estate industry are trying to figure out what potential impact tariffs might have on real estate space, supply and demand. And at a high level, tariffs can impact both supply and demand. On the supply side, you have rising costs of inputs to the construction process and renovation process. And so we're likely to see those rising costs diminish the new construction activities. And so we'll see less new supply coming to the market. That could have a knock-on positive effect to existing assets, which is what is largely in your portfolio. On the demand side, as you can imagine, the flow of goods and personal consumption, are key drivers for both industrial and retail sectors of real estate. And if we can continue to see if prolonged tariffs create kind of diminution in purchasing power, we'll see even impacts to local retail, to hospitality, to even apartment demand. And then if you look at the office sector, you could see employers trying to reduce their office footprint and reduce their demand for office space by encouraging remote work, since we've kind of figured out how to do that relatively efficiently. So like everything in real estate, though, it will be very location specific, depending on where your assets are and what businesses your tenants are in, and whether the tariffs have a protectionary or a cost effect to their businesses. And so I think a lot of us are kind of beginning to do some good guesstimates about the direction of impacts for these tariffs, but there's still a lot of tremendous amount of uncertainty with respect to the actual impact and the magnitude of those impacts. And with respect to interest rate, the Fed has its job cut out for itself, obviously, but if rates remain at these levels or increase, we're likely to see cap rates increase further. We're likely to see lenders become increasingly cautious in the space, and we'll probably see increased default rates in both residential and commercial real estate.
That's very rosy.
Thank you. I'm moving on to the better part. Which is the value of diversification, which clearly real estate can provide and which is one of the key investment objectives of your real estate program within the broader portfolio. Even within the asset class, there are multiple layers of diversification, including by property type, by geography, by manager, vintage year, and so on. And your portfolio is well diversified across all of these attributes. And you can see that in that level of diversification has really contributed to the strong performance of your portfolio relative to its benchmark over all periods. Just as a reminder, your real estate portfolio is anchored in a number of sector-specific separately managed accounts that can be described by their scalability, their fee efficiency, the quality of the management teams, the strong governance frameworks, and the tight alignment of interests. These are then layered around these are a series of open-end funds, core and core plus funds, as well as a number of more total return-seeking commingled closed-end funds and REITs. And so you have kind of the full toolbox of tools in your real estate program. Last, I would say, Ben mentioned kind of digitalization and decarbonization. I would add to that deglobalization as trends in kind of the larger real estate investing universe. And I think both your team, who are seasoned and well-regarded in the industry, and your partners, you have a kind of a deep heritage of strong partnerships in this program. They're working together to invest in these adaptations
to perpetuate kind of the creation of long-term value in this program. And so with that, go ahead and hand it to you.
Thank you. First slide, please, Austin. On the first slide two, we, just like Ben said, we put down the investment beliefs and we'll go on to page three. The role of real estate is really a diversifier. During volatile times, it tempers the volatility of the portfolio. We're not priced daily, so it helps a little bit with the return. And how do we diversify by strategy, core, non-core? Core are more stable assets, and non-core are more ground-up development and more renovation. Or with property types, we would be focused on industrial and multifamily, which has paid us well. And by geographic, we are investing in the smile of the country, coastal markets, and property types of small, medium, and large. We get the large trophy assets through our open-end funds, and our separate accounts have the small, medium-sized assets. And also various holding periods of assets where we have long-term hold or short-term, mid-term, when once value creation is done, we sell. And lastly, our bogey is Odyssey plus 50 dips. For the performance below, I'm happy to say that the performance of the portfolio has been well, outperformed all the benchmarks from all time periods. For the 1 year, it's pretty cool, 237 basis points. And even though with the write-downs, I will dig deeper on the write-downs later on. And since inception of 10.2 is comprised of almost 5% in income and 5% in appreciation. So pretty good returns. For the top left of the portfolio, we say that core is about 72%. Our portfolio is really centered on core. We're now at the, we're a little below the midpoint of 75%, but we're up in the approved ranges. Like I said, stable assets are heavily leased, 30 to 40% leverage, 8 to 10% return, and most of it is in income. 70% is from income. Non-core is about 26%. It's above the midpoint of 20%, but within approved ranges as well. And these cover ground-up development, major renovation of assets, 40 to 65% leverage, 11 to 15 plus return expectations, and more appreciation than income. And, of course, public REITs, we have that as a small placeholder for our alternatives portfolio. Top right, happy to say also that our separate account, 67% of the portfolio is managed by 10 managers. Only one is an open-end fund, and the rest are all separate account managers. And industrial is the only open-end fund. We have 36 managers. The top 10 are 67% of the portfolio, and the next 14 are 29% of the portfolio, and 12 managers for the assets, for the remaining as legacy assets. Geographic weights, we are a little below on the East Coast, a little below on the West Coast, and that's good because the West Coast really had less growth and higher in the South, and more growth was seen in on the South, so that has benefited us well. The only outlier is the Midwest. We have one large investment in Chicago, and also diversified, and international will grow in time. Property sector weights by benchmark, high conviction, like I said, industrial, multifamily, those have been best performers, and so we are heavy on that. Less office, still have challenges, but we have suburban office that have done well, so we are lucky in that way, but there were also some CBD assets that were hurt. Retail is mostly grocery anchored, which is a good tilt. It's need-based, resilient in today's market conditions. An alternative asset class, I'm going to talk about this more often now, is we want to focus on this because we think we get better risk-adjusted returns, medical office, student housing, senior housing, self-storage, manufactured housing. The benchmark, it's composed of 25 funds, all core, about $278 billion, 3,200 properties. We're about 6% of the benchmark. We have 229 properties, about 6% of the benchmark. And we have MSCI, who does our analysis of open-end and separate account. And if our fund, if that portfolio was added to the benchmark, we would be top quartile performer for the funds. So geographic weights, east, west, east, and south, which is similar to us. And property sectors also, I want to add that alternatives, we are higher, but finally Odyssey approved to add alternatives last fall up to 25%. So the key takeaways, the portfolio performance has done well. It's solid, it's resilient, generated income return, which is good for a pension fund, and it's our overweight to core assets have paid off. High concentration in best performing sectors, industrial and apartments. Less exposure in office. We want to sell some office later this year. Asset write-downs have moderated. It was really the first half of 2024 where write-downs were still there, and the second half of 24 just bottomed out. Fundamentals are healthy in most sectors. I don't think there's an oversupply except in multifamily in the Sun Belt, in life science, in some cities in the office. Are back, you know, like New York is back. So office is back in New York, but I feel for DC area and Virginia area with all the federal employees that are being laid off right now. Liquidity is returning. There's more bidders when market, you know, properties are for sale. Originally, last year, they had like 2 to 4 bidders. And now when properties are for sale, they have 7 to 10 bidders. So that tells me that the bid ask price has narrowed down, that people now are trying to transact, and there'll be more liquidity in the process. Real estate is within 7.5% and 17.5% midpoint is 12.5%, and we're a little over. We're about $1 billion over. So I will tell you later how we will control that over allocation. And staff is selective investing in high conviction and also alternative assets. Capital markets, I won't discuss. Christy already did that, so we'll skip to the other one. Year 2024, we committed 5 funds, $520 million in 5 investments, and we focused on industrial and alternative types. Also allocated 1 international core open-end fund in Europe and continued portfolio with a separate account app. The separate account is very high touch. We are involved in all major decisions. We hold wholesale analysis of each property. We travel and do site inspections. So it's a lot of work, but it's very rewarding because we really see the results from all these actions. We also hired a new investment analyst, Tara, in July 2024. And we continue to do our annual strategic portfolio reviews with each separate account manager. And due diligence with the Common School Fund also. Chris is involved in that. We did a small allocation to Common School Fund and further diversification in international. We're going to go to Asia this year and hope to invest next year in developed Asia only. So these are the 5 commitments we made. One was a separate account, LBA. We gave a top off for the separate account and then on their fund also because their fund is more non-core. Harrison Street, Europe, alternatives property type as well. So this is a good segue to our international geographic diversification at the same time still pursuing alternative property types. Sculpture is more kind of dislocations in the market. So it's an opportunistic global fund. And lastly, medical office. I think the aging population and exposure to medical office would be great. So here we go with the performance review. $13 billion or 12.97% is private real estate and 2.5% is public REITs. Core is 72% outperformed in all time periods since inception. The return of 10.15. Income is very strong, 6% and 3.6% appreciation. Non-core is 26%, outperformed the 1 and 3 year, but underperformed the 5 and 10 year. Due to legacy investments that are now in disposition mode and value creation are still ongoing on newly allocated funds. So conclusion, total portfolio has really outperformed in all time periods from the low 95 bips to high 243 bips. And with a heavy concentration on core, high sector bets on industrial multifamily, less office and growing alternative assets. The last slide I'm going to present is just to show you how the public markets, public REITs, and private markets react. The light blue bar is the OPERF portfolio. Light gray is the benchmark, and orange are public REITs. And the lag effect of public and private markets shows that during growth or expansion times, public REITs tend to appreciate ahead of private markets as they are priced daily, while private markets lag as they are appraised quarterly. But during times of correction, public REITs again is ahead of private markets and sometimes overshoots due to market sentiment and interest rate increases. Currently, public REITs have recovered their losses while private markets are still showing low appreciation.
All right, I'm going to spend a couple minutes on talking. I'll start off talking about our updates on ESG efforts we continue to make and implement in the portfolio. I would just start by saying that overall, I think the industry has really come a long ways in the last few years. On slide 12 here, I think the main takeaway here is that we've really integrated this process into all of our process of our underwriting, our questioning of our managers, their efforts. This comes through in a number of areas. I won't go too far in the weeds today, but you know, there's areas like their integration of their staff and diversification of their staffs. Also areas of, probably the biggest area with a real estate practitioner is the E, environmental and energy consumption. Our industry has really come a long ways about being more transparent about and more aware, really, about, the footprint that real estate can play in the environment. And, it makes good business sense to try to reduce your energy consumption. That just drives your results at the bottom line. So that's been just a practice that we're seeing just a lot of improvements on in this area that we're continuing to monitor. On the next slide. This is just a snapshot. This is a tool that we've shared with you in the past. It's one that we've continued to use. It illustrates one of the risk factors of real estate. It's a real asset that you can't relocate if you have a natural disaster. So this is just a factor that our managers use and we use as well to just to look at and understand, when you buy an asset, what are the physical risks of that? And this map here, so we use Moody's Climate on Demand is a tool that just kind of ranks for each location, each asset, the different risk profiles for like climate risk. This map here is an example of an output of our separate account portfolio that shows the flood risk of these different assets. It's just a tool that we keep in mind as we're making investments, as we're holding them, and our managers are as well assessing our portfolio. Next slide here is really highlighting just the different attributes we can get out of the different structures that we have at our toolkit. As Christy alluded to, we have the full spectrum of vehicles that we can invest in real estate. Our core, the anchor of our portfolio is our separate accounts. That represent over half of the portfolio. And that really gives us the two biggest things about it is, transparency and control. So we're able to really drive a lot of decisions here with our portfolio and really have a lot more input than we could than we do in the fund sectors. The next two biggest sectors are open-ended funds and our closed-ended funds. Those give us a lot of sector-specific, tactical plays that we like, strategic plays, I should say. And our, the open-ended ones give us in normalized markets, some form of liquidity that we could use some rebalancing in a market like today in the correction, that liquidity really doesn't exist. And then the closed-end funds, they tend to operate more like a private equity type fund. So you're in it for the duration. Slide 15. We put this here really just to kind of illustrate the build out of the portfolio over the recent years. These two sectors, the core portfolio is broken up mostly by our separate accounts that's shown at the bottom. And those we've got nine relationships. And then the top section is our open-ended funds. And we've kind of added to those, as you can see, kind of 1 to 3 relationships there per year. And, we've got two recent ones that we made as Gloria mentioned here, those are still yet to be have any capital drawn. And we highlight here the returns as well, because this represents about 75% of the portfolio. This really is the driver of the main returns here. And our open-end funds, as we're proud to show that, you know, those have outperformed over every period. Our separate accounts, while a little bit underperformance for the trailing 1 year, over the medium and longer term periods have really been a meaningful driver of outperformance. 16, I'll just briefly talk, this is really more of a history lesson to kind of show where we used to be and how we redefined the role of real estate. You know, if you go back about a decade, the role of real estate was much more of a total return profile. You know, only over 50% of the portfolio was opportunistic value add. It was total return seeking. And only about a quarter of the portfolio was core and private. That has really flipped in the recent years, and we really made concerted efforts to grow grow the core. And so today it's now, you know, almost three quarters of core, you know, which is driving. It's been a very good income producer and a stabilized return for the portfolio. Just a 17 is just, you know, we'd like to do occasional check-ins with what our peers are doing, how much risk are we taking relative to our peer set. You know, the benchmark of our peers is about 80% core, 20% non-core. You know, today, you know, as of 9:30, most recent numbers we have at the time of this publication here, you know, we're a little bit more risky than our peers. We're at 72% core. If you add in the publicly traded, it's about 75%, you know, relevant core and about a quarter non-core. And if you take our target, if you take the midpoints of our policy targets for real estate, we get to about where we are today, 75% core and 20% non-core. So today we're slightly higher risk than both our peers and our policy midpoints, but areas that we feel comfortable going forward. And then the last slide I'm going to touch on is just a diversification slide. This, Gloria already covered one that showed the total portfolio on our relative benchmark. This really just breaks down our core, which is, again, a little over 70% of the portfolio. Comparing that to the benchmark, we really are pretty close to the benchmark by property types. Slight underweight to retail, slight overweight to our non-traditional. We particularly like that overweight to the non-traditional. I think if we had our rather, we're aiming to try to reduce our office exposure coming in the next couple of years. So hopefully we get that down, and that would be our objective. With that, I'll hand it over to Chris.
Okay, this slide gives you a snapshot of the debt profile across our separate account portfolio. That's really where we have the best look-through transparency to the debt situation. And I think it's best reviewed in context with prior years. We're sitting at 45% LTV across the total separate account portfolio. That's up about 360 basis points from last year, and that was really driven by depreciation and write-downs at the asset level as opposed to increases in the debt itself. It's stayed in that 70 to 75% range in terms of fixed versus floating. And our overall weighted average rate, I was surprised actually to see it's 4.6%. It's only up 5 basis points from last year. So I think that's really a testament to our managers' interest rate management and the ability to lock in long-term fixed rate financing or, you know, synthetically fixing via swaps and caps. And then our maturity schedule, it remains fairly evenly staggered, which is always what we shoot for. Next. So this is one of two slides showing our pacing. The high-level takeaways, I think, from this slide are that we've remained within the policy range, which is the lighter dotted lines. We're currently above the midpoint, which is the green line, but as we'll get to, we're trending downward closer to that midpoint. And then the other takeaway, if you're looking at the vertical lines, is along the lines of what Christy had commented at earlier, just the lack of transaction activity in the last few years. It has not really been a seller's environment. Fortunately, we've been able to avoid forced sale situations in our separate accounts, but that's why you've seen greater outflows and inflows on the cash side. This is an overview of our unfunded commitment balance, and it's important to note that this $3.2 million is not included in the allocation on the prior slide. This $3.2 billion represents a net drawdown of about $400 million over the past year. Again, sort of speaking to the slower investment pacing and the lack of transaction activity. The big takeaways from this one are 64% of our uncalled capital is dedicated to non-core strategies, which we feel pretty good about given the current dislocated market environment. And it gives us ample dry powder sort of on the sidelines across various managers and strategies to capitalize on that. If you look at the chart on the right, the majority of the unfunded capital is committed to diversified mandates and those sectors in which we have high conviction, multifamily and industrial and alternatives, not a whole lot, in areas that, that are currently distressed. And I would say more than half of this is allocated to open-ended structures within the portfolio where we do have some options to manage liquidity. Next slide. This is a little bit more in-depth review of our pacing. This is based on a model that we've, that we update fairly often. It's based on a reasonable, realistic set of assumptions. I would argue that it's fairly conservative at this point, namely because it assumes no additional write-downs. We've taken our lumps, we've modeled our lumps over the last few years, and this assumes that we're essentially at bottom in terms of value. Given what's going on in the markets, that may or may not play out over the next few months. So I think that gives us some room here. The assumption is fairly moderate deployment on the order of $500 million a year over the next few years. And as you can see, that gets us back to our target within a fairly reasonable time period. And then this slide is basically showing the relative returns across the four major sectors, office, multifamily, industrial, and retail. The biggest takeaways on this to me, it's giving you sort of the color-coded relative performance each year. Retail weathered some significant headwinds. If you look, from 2017 up to 2021, was consistently the lowest performer in the group. That was really, the initial growth of e-commerce penetration, as well as just oversupply and overbuilding in retail. So now, you see retail has weathered those storms, is back on top. In 2023, you could argue it was the least bad of the four, with still slightly negative performance. But in 2024, the outperformance was pretty significant. Office, the other interesting one to me is office and green. Everyone associates commercial real estate with office. The last time that office was a top performer was pre-GFC, 2006, 2007, and has largely tread near the bottom on a relative basis since then. And so, high-level takeaway, this is fairly consistent with our worldview and how we've tried to shape the portfolio going forward, the sectors that we've leaned into, and those that we've de-emphasized. And so I think this will continue to inform our portfolio construction into the future. So our 2025 initiatives, consistent with all of that, budgeting between $400 million and $750 million in new commitments in line with the pacing. A lot of that's largely spoken for already. Continuing to monitor the liquidity levers in the portfolio. And what this really means is pulling back on dividend reinvestment in open-ended funds where we're able to do that, and pushing that into funds that are in the more non-traditional and alternative sectors to incrementally grow that exposure. And then we do have the ability to manage our capital recycling in the separate accounts, and we're in constant dialogue with those managers as to highest and best use of dollars and aligning with our objectives going forward. And then continuing to push internationally, as Gloria mentioned, we're exploring Asia to sort of partner on to the investments that we've started to make in developed Europe. To slowly build up to a level of diversification within the portfolio from a global standpoint.
This slide is our mandatory reporting. At the top, you'll see the RCP stats. This applies to assets in which we own more than 51% of the underlying and also have a degree of investment decision-making control. Takeaway here is over 99% of expenditures have gone to responsible contractors. And then the non-mandate activity note, that's more or less a vestige of our older separate account structures in which some of the managers had the ability to do things outside of the mandate with staff discretion. We don't, we've modified a lot of our accounts, so that's not even the case anymore. So nothing to report on that front. I'll throw it back to Gloria to wrap up.
Yeah, so to wrap up, I just want to, on the cash flow, I looked at the last nine years of cash flow, distributions and contributions. For the 8 years, we were self-funding real estate. But for last year, that's when we had the shortfall where the distributions were not enough, you know, to cover all the contributions. So I'm hoping that next year, this year would be better. We are working hard. So performance is strong. And during times of correction, properties, you know, perform. Income generation is consistent, so that's good. The core portfolio is has a perfect role for the pension fund. The write-downs have bottomed out. We don't know what the tariffs will do to our properties, but we are ready and able. We think we have good managers who are very nimble, and construction will stop. So existing assets will really have less competition. So asset management and property management would be key events that they should really do a good job of managing the properties well. And having $3 billion of unfunded capital, it gives us an opportunity to buy, you know, properties at a lesser price and dislocated properties. We think we will be cash flow positive. You can hold on to me for that, Brett. I'm trying. Overall, fundamentals are still healthy. Real estate is an effective long-term inflation hedge because we're able to raise the rents every year. It's part of their lease contracts. So we're covering inflation increases there. And focus on demographic-driven assets rather than GDP growth will deliver better risk-adjusted returns. And continue on international. The team will be traveling. And the levers we pull, I think Chris covered it, on managing liquidity, the dividend reinvestment, we're going to stop that on some funds, except for that we think that we should really grow on the alternatives. The selective acquisition on separate accounts, we're going to limit them to a certain amount every year. Even though they have larger, separate account managers are allowed to invest their capital and their gains. And we're going to limit that to a certain amount every year. And then also sale of assets. We, in the pacing model, we put in 15% of sales. It may not happen 15% per year, but overall average, we're looking at when value creation is done, they should sell assets. And redeem open-end funds. We're still in redemption of three funds. And also for the $3 billion unfunded, 15 to 20% are reserves for our separate account managers that they will never call. And they're holding that for distress, pay downs, or maybe, you know, just renegotiation with tenants or with lenders. So $600 million is really there for kind of a reserve. That's my conclusion. Any questions, please?
Yeah, first of all, thank you. I just need to get a little bit smarter, and if you would just click down on retail. What is the driver? Because just from my perspective, I'm thinking who would be investing. So can you just speak to that a little bit so I can get a smarter, just trying to understand. And then, Christy, you said something about deglobalization. Ugh, what a tongue tie. Can you talk a little bit more about that, kind of what you're seeing and its impact? So those were my two questions. Thank you.
Sure. For retail, the portfolio has focused on grocery-anchored retail. So when COVID hit, groceries, still people still went shopping for food. So that was a home run for us.
Okay.
The malls were hurting,
yes,
but construction has stopped in a long time because of the distress in the malls. And so they've retooled and they kind of change the tendency of there's more food, less of clothing. So managers and owners have really restructure their retail, and their parking lot, they're turning into multifamily. Some are turning it into multifamily assets, and because there's excess parking. So there's a lot of retooling that has happened in retail, and now it's doing well again.
No, that helps.
Yes.
I'm just thinking of something in food deserts and how there's some construction in certain neighborhoods. So thank you. That makes sense there.
I think the best comparison I've heard is retail went through its pain, you know, pre-COVID, and that's kind of where office is now. So retail went through this period where it was overbuilt, you know, folks that couldn't compete with e-commerce or figure out how to sort of merge that with their brick-and-mortar operations. They, you know, were more or less weeded out over a prolonged period of time, and it underperformed. That's kind of where office is now, where folks are trying to figure out what their space utilization looks like going forward, and, you know, what the office building is that people are going to want to be in long term. And so I think it's you hear people make that comparison, and I think it's pretty relevant.
I want to add a comment too. Nordstrom's have reinvented themselves. The e-commerce section is just widened. It's so big. People pick up the merchandise in their stores, and then they buy more than they expected. So it has done well for them, and that's how stores are doing it. Target and Walmart, they all have their e-commerce in the stores, so people will come in and shop some more and collect their products.
From a real estate perspective, my comment about deglobalization was I feel like about a decade ago, the industry really felt like from the property market perspective, there was a lot of synchronization happening. And I think it was a time where U.S. investors, when they were going overseas, still expected a premium to go overseas. And what's I think the realization has been is that you're not going to get a premium for being a non-native investor in ex-U.S. economies. And also that there tends to be there's more of a realization that there's dispersion in both the property market cycles in different geographic arenas, so Europe versus the U.S. or U.S. versus Asia. There are differences in the timing of this property market cycles, as well as some of the capital market cycle dynamics. And so you've got property types that are well established here in the U.S. that are nascent in other geographies. And so that's an argument for your team kind of going into alternative property types in Europe, for example, and getting the advantages of those strategies in those geographies in addition to those strategies in this geography. So that was kind of what I was trying to allude to.
Questions for the real estate team.
Kara, it's Lorraine. I've got a question. This is on liquidity. And can you just remind me overall, like, what percent of this portfolio do you consider liquid, either through open-end or choices in separate accounts of, you know, reinvesting dividends? How do you view the kind of overall ratio, knowing it's mostly illiquid, of liquidity?
2.5% are in public REITs, Lorraine, so those are pretty liquid.
Right.
You can sell that anytime. The open-end funds have liquidity, they say, during normal times. So we have 25% of the portfolio there that we could probably get out of if, you know, when demand and supply is in kind of balance. But during correction times, we know that it's not as liquid because they're not able to sell assets. They can only send your money back if they're able to sell assets. So that's the problem we've had in the past 2 years. But we're seeing some distributions now from our open-end funds. They're starting to sell. And so I think that liquidity will be coming back for open-end funds. And as we also redeem more, we have 9 open-end funds. We could probably redeem on some more. We only have 3 redemptions right now. So we could probably increase our redemptions to other funds. And lastly, the separate account generates a lot of cash flow. That's where our, you know, because it's a core portfolio, we think that the income, the cash flow, if cash flow is 5%, I'm sorry, if income is 5%, 4% will be cash flow of half of the portfolio during good times. So those are the liquidity levers that we have.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
Well, similar to the real assets portfolio, just a congratulations to you all on a great job and a difficult.
Thank you.
We will move straight into the next agenda item, which is an action item. That it changed the investment policy. Jamie doesn't have support.
I know. Luckily, I'll be short and sweet as well. I shouldn't take the whole 20 minutes that's allocated, but
we're running late.
Yeah. I'm going to make it up for us. Yes. All right. Well, good morning, Chair Samples and members of the council. For the record, Jamie McCreary, Service Model Program Manager. And like you said, today I'm here for seeking approval for updates to IMB 407, the public university's common policy, often referenced as just the common policy. Before I dive into the policy updates, though, I did want to give a reminder and also a little bit of history on the universities, because the Oregon University System was dissolved in 2014. So therefore, all seven systems at that time then elected their own independent boards. ORS Chapter 352 established that the authority for the universities can invest monies with the Oregon State Treasury and enter into agreements with us for us to then manage and hold the funds for them. So in response to that, Treasury created an institutional quality investment policy framework, which is INB 407, the Public University Common Policy, and seven universities can participate, but I do want to make note that not all do so. As detailed in the Common Policy, Treasury offers a limited set of internal and external investment management services for the universities. On the internally managed side, the primary fund that we manage is the university's public university core bond fund, referenced usually as PUF. The OIC approved the establishment of the public university core bond fund and the guidelines in 2014. On the external management, currently two universities have elected for Treasury to oversee investment of surplus monies through that external management. We'd like to expand upon the bond fund options for those universities. So I've been working closely with operations, the universities, and OIC consultants on this added service. Therefore, an approved list of core and core bond plus bond funds were created. The use of the approved list allows for each university to have more autonomy in how they decide to manage each of their portfolios. Other updates to policy were to maintain fiduciary best practices and clarify ambiguous language. And I will open it up to any questions.
The suggested changes, there's a red line version as well as a green version. Does anyone have any questions on those recommended changes to the policy? It's like a positive upgrade in the services that we're able to offer to our clients.
Yes.
If there are none, we would entertain a motion to approve.
I'll second the motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
There are no abstentions, so the motion is approved and the changes are approved.
Well, perfect. Thank you. Okay. Give you back some time.
Don't know if you all have noticed, but Jamie has been up here most meetings, and that is because she is working very hard to add focus to our other clients other than OPERF, of which there are many. So thank you.
You're welcome, and I will see you next meeting as well.
Before we break, two things. The first is the governor has asked me to participate in a business roundtable and press conference about tariffs in Salem at 1:30. So I will not be back after the break because I need to do a couple things and then get to Salem on time. So thank you for your indulgence. And because I won't be there, I'm going to make one comment related to the public comment period, if I may. We received a lot of public commentary about Tesla and whether we should be invested in Tesla. It is 100% true that we are invested in Tesla. It is a tiny percentage. It's just over a tenth of a percent of our entire portfolio in OPERF. And I personally sent a letter to the board chair last week asking some pretty tough questions about what's going on and what kind of supervision the board is giving Mr. Musk as the CEO and what that's doing to the stock price. So we are paying very close attention to the Tesla situation, and I and other state treasurers around the nation who are invested in Tesla. But being invested gives us the opportunity to write those letters and to hold the board accountable for their supervision of Mr. Musk. And so I just wanted to get that on the record because we received so much public commentary about that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Into break, and then we will actually, we have the forward calendar up, which we no longer have in our agenda. But Rex, any comments about the forward calendar before we break?
No, I don't think so.
Great. Okay, let's take a break till 11:35, and then we'll be back here for open discussion and public comment. Thank you. Okay. Back to the meeting. This is the open discussion portion of the meeting for OIC members, staff, and consultants to bring up any topic for discussion and or to request something to be added to a future agenda item. Are there any comments or items for discussion? Hearing none, we will move to the open comments section of the meeting. And we have two commenters today. I am not going to read my script on open comment period because both of these commenters have been here before. Sue Palmiter and Carolyn Cahoot, if you would both like to come up.
You may be first.
Oh, thank you. I have my 5 minutes.
Sure.
Just me today. Thank you. Mr. Samples, Treasurer Steiner, if she listens to this later, and members of the council. Having to speak for the record, my name is Sue Palmiter, co-lead
of the Divest Oregon Coalition. My message from the coalition is threefold today. One, we expect the Treasury staff to be implementing the statutory obligations of the COAL Act. In the 2024 progress report of the Pathway to Net Zero, 30 million worth of coal companies were listed along with their transition assessment scores. One of those listed, Consol Energy, which got the highest or best transition score, 78 out of 100, is clearly not transitioning from coal. You can go to their website. You'll see that they state they're a thermal coal company and they have no intention of transitioning, yet they got this high score. They should have an extremely low score and be excluded from your holdings by law. We have no idea if you are fulfilling your statutory obligations, since Treasury only publishes data of their public holdings once a year. We're waiting for information about Consol Energy and other exclusions. Two, there's no way for the Treasury to get to net zero as described in HB 2200 with real assets investments we heard about in this meeting. We see the business as usual decisions described by Mr. Mahon today in direct conflict with these goals. These real asset private investments are at risk of being stranded assets and will generate pollution of our air and water for decades to come. We're waiting for the details of how the major action in the pathway to net zero of no new private investments in fossil fuels will be implemented. We're waiting. Number three, we're disappointed that the Treasury continues to cherry pick what data they present to the public, to the legislature, and this council. This occurred in the testimony submitted in opposition to SB 681, where private equity returns were reported, but not real asset returns, where the majority of the private market emissions are generated, and have poor long-term returns in the S&P 500. I just checked right during this meeting. So as of today, even with the public markets doing as poorly as they are, they the 10-year returns for real assets is 3 to 4% lower than the 10-year returns for the S&P 500. Why weren't those in that comment? And now today, Mr. Mann reported the 5-year returns for the S&P 500 energy stocks, slide 60 of your public book, but not the 1-year, 3-year, and most importantly, 10-year returns, which are all abysmal compared to the general S&P 500 as of today. The 10-year return for the S&P 500 energy stocks is 0.35% for the 10-year returns, compared to the 9.8% for the 10-year returns for the S&P 500. Why isn't that in that slide? He chose 5 years. We really ask this question seriously. Why are those returns reported just for the 5 years? We don't believe you need the real asset upstream energy investments. Others are doing just fine. In fact, better without them. New York City pension, NYSERS pension fund, had a 9.9% return in 2024, much better than the PERS returns. And they are ahead of schedule on reaching net zero, and they've already divested their public equity in fossil fuels and are limiting their upstream private investments. We just keep asking, why aren't those returns reported? Why aren't you comparing yourselves to a fund like that? So Treasury can always find data that fits their story of business as usual, whether or not it's the whole picture. This cherry picking of returns data by Treasury staff to the public and to you must stop. Thank you for your service.
Thank you. Carolyn.
There.
You hearing better or worse?
There you go. There we go. Even though I came in late because of snail pace traffic on 26 and 217, I enjoyed what I was able to hear more easily than previous sessions, previous gatherings. And I very much appreciate whoever else other than Kara, encouraging people to speak more clearly, and our sound person here upping the volume. I'm hoping that other people other than me were able to hear better today than other times. And I don't know, you people haven't changed, but I know that Elizabeth Steiner is new, and it's been since she's been here that the sound has been much better. So I don't know where the relationships are there, but thank you.
Thank you. And that concludes our meeting today. We will see everyone back here in May. Thank you. Sure.